Right, it is Wednesday the 17th of June, and I'm here with Graham Watts, who's kindly agreed to be interviewed as part of the Mill Road Depot project, which is part of the Mill Road History Project. So Graham, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me. Could you just confirm your full name and date and place of birth, please?
Graham Robert Watts, 4th of the 9th, 1947, and born in Hornchurch, in Essex.
Hornchurch in Essex, right. Thank you. And how did you come to be working for Cambridge City Council?
Well, I trained as an apprentice gardener, first of all, and then went to Kew to do the diploma there, the Kew diploma. I went into parks management, and that was in about 1971. And so most people that trained in horticulture then went into local authority parks departments. That was the main source of reasonable employment. And worked through London Borough Barnet, then a bit out to Brentwood in Essex, and then moved up to Cambridge. So I went from being a district parks officer at Barnet to assistant parks manager at Brentwood. And then when the parks managers, or parks officers it was called at Cambridge Post came up, I thought that would be a nice progression after spending 5 years at Brentwood. So you had this fairly linear well-trod path for, in public horticulture. And so I arrived in Cambridge in 79 and managed the parks in Cambridge and other ancillary facilities for about 5 years, and then was promoted to be the assistant amenities and recreation officer. So I was deputy to the sort of director of the department, and then took on things like indoor leisure, swimming pools and sports centres and things like that, and on the cemeteries and crematorium, which were often, most parks managers actually ended up managing cemeteries and crematoria as well. So you dealt with people's leisure right through their lives into death. But and then there were significant changes ahead in the early 80s, when certain services came up for competition, compulsory competitive tendering, where the then Conservative government nominated building services primarily to be enforced, to put out a competition. The idea being is to introduce competition into local authorities where the feeling was that direct labour forces were either ineffective or lacked value for money, or both, and wanted to I suppose, ginger up that sort of market. They did that successfully in the early 80s. I looked at it and I thought, well, if this government gets elected again under the bold Margaret Thatcher, which seemed highly likely, then they're not going to stop at building services. They're going to work on to the other frontline services, which included the work I was doing in parks, which was described as ground maintenance, and probably onto leisure as well. And so we prepared for that by becoming what we described in Cambridge as a pseudo-DSO, or the then city engineer called us, rather sneeringly, a pseudo-DSO. But we just thought this was good preparation for what we saw as potentially inevitable. And so it came to pass, actually, that in the late 80s, the government then pronounced that a range of services would be coming out for competition. In grounds maintenance, they did something quite bizarre. They said because the competition in the private sector wasn't necessarily there, you put out 20 to 25% a year, so you don't suddenly flood the market and you get no competition. And so that was going to be either success or death by a thousand cuts kind of thing. And they also nominated refuse, recycling and street cleaning and building cleaning, including public toilets and things like that. So there was a whole raft of these blue-collar, then called, services coming up. The council then looked at that and said, well, this is affecting sort of about 50% of the turnover of the entire authority, and it's certainly affecting nearly 50% of the entire workforce of the authority. So it's a bit of a potential Armageddon, if you like. And so he said, well, we need to face this in a more strategic and managed way, so we'll create a contracting department. And so in 1989, or late 1988, City Services was born, and the first task was to appoint a director to the department. And that was an internal competition held because there was my role would be directly affected and would cease to exist as a result of this, you know, job. And so would my sort of opposite number, who was then managing the sort of building and highways type services at Mill Road Depot. I was at Cherry Hinton Hall in the wonderful park, sylvan surroundings, and he was in good old Mill Road Depot. And there was a couple of other, my deputy, and it was John Delderfield who was the, you know, the assistant engineer in charge of the Mill Road side of things, and his deputy. So there was four of us. But the reality was, it was a head-to-head between John and myself, I suspect, and I was the each-way outside bet. And so we went. But the politicians actually had, I think they had an agenda, and so it wasn't really terribly fair competition for John. Well, probably not for a pair of us in a way, because I think John Delderfield, in his role, had sort of in the early stages a competition for building and highway services, so he had competition experience, successful competition experience. I think he'd rubbed a number of the key politicians up the wrong way, in the sense that, you know, I'm a contractor, I'm running the show, and you may be there, but you're nothing to do with me really, except when I want you to do something for me. And that made them a little bit jittery, because it was a highly unionised workforce, particularly in all the cleansing services. Everyone was in GMB, and of course competition was a big threat to their livelihoods, and it made them very anxious. And being a Labour authority, with strong affiliations of course to the trade unions, it made them extremely anxious. So we went into, and I was unaware of this at the time, and so was John. John was blissfully unaware of it, as to how this had been sort of stacked up. So I got the feeling, even if I had answered nonsense to the questions in the interview. Actually, at the time, I was suffering from flu. So I managed to turn up at the interview in one suit jacket and a different pair of suit trousers. And it was only afterwards, when my wife measured my temperature, she said, "You've got a temperature of 102, you should be in bed." So I'm not quite sure what I said in the interview, but as I said, I don't think it would have mattered that much. And so I got the job. And
when was that? What?
That was in late 1988, November 1988. And that was a real shock to most people, except the members doing it and the chief executive. And it was a shock to me, because I thought, you know, you just go along to sort of make up their numbers. And it was an incredible shock to John. You know, he was a good friend, and that was one of the saving graces of this, because unlike the private sector, where you would, you know, the person who was unsuccessful in that head-to-head would be, you know, "Thanks for everything you've done, here's a golden handshake, goodbye." Well, local authorities don't tend to do things. You don't give, well, it's my knowledge, you don't give golden handshakes. And John was going to be my deputy. So they'd immediately created, effectively, potentially a major problem, because John had the majority workforce. I was going to the table with probably about 80 people, and he had something in excess of 400. So that, you know, that had all the portents for disaster. Oh, and in the succeeding, from beginning of 89 through to the end of 91, two-thirds of city services turnover was subject to compulsory competitive tendering. So it could be the shortest-lived department in history if we didn't all get our acts together. And I suppose that was a saving grace. There was so much on, of which all our futures depended, particularly in management, because if you lose contracts, they'll keep the workforce, reduce their terms and conditions and all the rest of it. But they'll keep them on because they need a workforce, but management, and bringing their own people in. Mm-hmm. And
do you remember, have you got a strong memory of arriving at the depot the first day? I mean, had you been there before because of working with Parks?
I'd been in there very rarely working with Parks. The only time you needed to go into the depot was to have your vehicle repaired or to pick up fuel, because they had the fuel pumps. And so for me, I didn't need fuel and I didn't need my vehicle repaired, so it was quite rare to go there. But the then city engineer, Mr. Cresswell, who was the classic old school engineers, he ruled supreme over everything he looked at. If you went into his office, it was a rarity, you know, big oak panelled office. That sort of is the old style, last of the old style sort of directors, if you like, or chief officers. And he phoned me up and he said, "Graham," he said, "you know, this is going to be potentially awkward." He backed me for the job. So there was no angst from his side, because he fell out with John Delderfield a number of times and felt that it was going to be problematic. He says, "I'll take you around the depot." And so he did, and that was a very, very awkward thing, because you're going around shaking people's hands and they were sort of, you know, possibly wanted to shake my throat at the same time, I'm not sure. But
that's how you, the first day?
The first day.
You arrived, you
Yeah, I was taken around by... He was retiring. He was going to retire. And so he didn't have any problems with his department being sort of halved in size as such. It's changed because there's other changes going on in the authority at the same time as a result of this. And so he took me round. And then, and of course, the other awkward thing is that there was no free office. And so having... Of course, John, you know, he was absolutely crushed by not getting the job. That was his lifetime achievement up in smoke. He knew he'd never get that again. So here was a guy, and if there's a spark of humanity in you, there is one or two sparks in me, it's not to heap further anguish upon him. So John kept his office. Laurie, his number two, who was very good, would long-term be, I suspect, my right-hand person, he kept his office. And it was only the head of stores, Cliff Weeks, who, I don't know whether he had reasons of his own, but anyway, he said, well, Graham, you're at my office. Because initially I said, I'll sit in the conference room. I need to find out about the organisation and its people. So I said, it might be good. I don't have an office. You're not associated. You've got to go and see the director in an office. So, but of course, everyone else was uncomfortable with that. I was immensely comfortable. I thought it was quite good fun. So I thought, this is a bit sort of different, you know, sort of catch people a bit on the blind side.
Is that how you were in parks? Were you out and about?
Mm. Oh, yes.
That's your style? That
wasn't my style was, yeah. You know, I'd spend possibly, in total, probably at least a month during the year in odd spells on the tours. All the bedding on the Christ Pieces, for instance. I'd do the designs and then spend 3 days helping the guys plant it. And in the winter, when we had projects like tree planting, I'll go out and help with that, and you know, help lead them where we're going to put the trees and do those sort of things.
So you carried that style over into
you carry style forward, and yes. You need to do it fairly consistently and do it over time. Otherwise, guys don't trust you. Because if you can work, I worked in the parks guys. I worked with them. Well, it was a month. We had a countryside commission grant to plant up Coldham's Common with 23,000 trees, and we had to do it by Christmas Eve. And this, we got this money on the first, I think it was last week in November. And it was literally all hands to the pump. The only person left in the office was the then typist. You had typist in those days. And Heather was left in the office. Everyone else, landscape architects, all of us went out. Because we were working for a month, after about a week, 10 days, no one sort of, there was not sort of, oh, you know, as the boss. There was none of that because you were working, you were eating your sandwiches and having your cups of tea and all the rest of it all together. And it was quite nice because everyone relaxed and they weren't sort of putting on a set of behaviours that were different to what you would call the sort of indigenous behaviour. So you really get to know the people and what they're really thinking. I think I've described it as the underbelly, you know, you really get to know that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I took that style in, which I needed to do in Mill Road, because there was a number of stresses. One, they didn't expect me to be in charge, and they think, well, he's not going to be competent, he's a gardener. You know, straw out his ears. I mean, there's long held and probably still... I mean, gardening's come up a bit, I think, in the national psyche compared to those days. But at that time, you know, if your son or daughter couldn't do anything else, then put them in gardening. It was that kind of end of the spectrum. And so I needed to get round and not only just to sort of see what people are doing and get some understanding of the psyche of the organisation, but also to get an understanding of what they were doing, because many of these services were completely new to me. I mean, I'd never dealt with housing repairs. I'd never dealt with refuse. Even street cleaning. There's lots of services there with their own sort of ways and complexities.
Did you have a strong brief of what you were supposed to deliver, or was this just up for grabs with the compulsive competitive tendering? Were you just up to you to make a strategy? How did you go about?
Important point, actually, because right from the outset, I said to the members, I said, I'll need to have some training because no authority had been that way before on that scale. And lots of authorities were doing what we were doing. They were sort of going for what they call the twin-hatted approach, where you had a chief officer who had a contracting division under him and a client division. 50% did that. The other 50% said, no, that's not a strong enough split. I think that, you know, you need to have firmer walls between the two functions so that the audit commission don't think we're going to be gerrymandering the process and undermining it. So there's genuine competition. And so the other 50%, like us, went for this complete separation. What happened was the members said, well, yeah, we understand that, Graham. He says, you know, this is new for all of us. So they sent me on a management course for business planning, because I was expected to produce a business plan for the organisation, and on marketing. I did three days on marketing. That was very illuminating.
I was going to say, how was that? What did you feel you learned or not learned?
Well, you learned that. I think with marketing is the classic thing that I came away with that was that if you're doing a good job and for your residents, your customers, they will tell four other people you're doing a good job. If you're doing a bad job, they'll tell 20. And so you learn very early on, you know, you need the residents on side. It's all very well winning in competition, but you need the residents to appreciate you're doing a good job for them, so they support the outcome of the process and the quality of, you know, what they're getting, what we can do for them. So I suppose they were the two lessons. And funny enough, on business planning, I did some training on it up at Birmingham University, and John Delafield came and Laurie Weaver. So that was number two and number three. And we formed a good relationship with the guy doing the course. And we'd all realised, we said, look, business planning is anathema to local authorities. It's never existed. You know, this is... So you're not looking at some sort of template. You can't use the private sector template, you know, which is about profitability. You know, it doesn't ring very true with local authority and, you know, money from residents, you know, council tax, etc. And so we said, we need to devise a business plan that suits local authorities. So we wrote a book with, I can't remember his name now, the guy who was a real Brummy, so you needed to sort of need to work with him for about 3 days to understand what he was saying. He was very broad Brummy, but he was brilliant. And so we set up how you do a business plan. And we, first of all, we did it for city services, where you set strategic objectives for the organisation, things you must achieve to survive. And then as a result of that, success objectives. What would the organisation look like and how you want to be and the values? And we thought that would work quite well. And the members, the councillors, thought that would work, you know, quite well. They endorsed that. And so City Services was born, and we said you would produce a 3-year business plan with an annual review. And that's what I set out writing with the help of John and other staff. And then we gave presentations to all the workforce, which is quite a long, well, not a long process, but quite a complex process, because if you've got staff like refuse, they come in at 6 a.m, heave loads of bins all day, and then go home. And so trying to get people to, we had to get them before they went to work. And so, you know, some of it, it's difficult to tell, you know, some of it, I think people participated, and others, it was like they were just going through, right, when do I get out to do the job? My vehicle's running, sort of thing. It's running outside, so.
And was that just a process of, you know, rolling it out, a way of getting people to go along with the change, or was it actually a consultation? Was there any element of...
Yeah, there was a consultation as part of it, and backing that, because we saw that as being quite cumbersome, so that was really, I suppose, a communication process. And prior to that, I suppose another step I haven't outlined is that part of my brief when I went for interviews, you have to sort of set out a paper, you know, here's this new department, how are you going to run it? Why should we choose you? And all that sort of stuff. And I proposed to set up what would be called an enterprise board, which would have representatives, have, you know, each of the heads of service in the department on the board, including senior management, and include representatives from each of the unions. There was Unison, GMB, and I can't remember the Builders Union, which is since no longer exists, but there was another union representing some of the building staff. And so then there'd be a personnel person. So it was a bit cumbersome in a way, but because there was so much angst in the depot and so much gossip, you know, people, if they don't hear things, then let's make it up. And it's much more interesting if you make it up. It's much more, you know, salacious and all the rest of it. So I thought, well, I'll get all the main players round the table. And, you know, and I did do that. That was part of my brief, and the members accepted that. And there were, you know, I think the other manager went along with it. There's no much choice, really. It was endorsed by members, and that's where I wanted to go. And they, you know, open mind, I think. Hope, in most cases. So we sat around, we had the conference room, we sat around this table. Well, it was 25. So, mind you, having said that, you know, and the Conservative and any government cabinet, I think they have about 30 round the table, don't they? So I don't make any apologies for the numbers, because they're trying to run the country with 30 round one table and all trying to get a word in. I'm not sure. I knew this was not going to be a long-term objective, to have an enterprise board this big. But because we were going through these difficult days of having to win all our work, the first thing I said to all the staff, I said, you know, if you don't hear it here, then it's not true. We'll meet, and that time it was on a fortnightly basis. I said, we'll try and slacken it out to a month, but because we've got so much going on, there's so much change, and there's so many worries and stresses in the organisation, then we'll meet every fortnight, and what will be here will be the truth. And that's what I want you to convey outside the, you know, outside this room. And hopefully in time convey a sense of unity, that while we might have disagreements here on approaches, that as far as all those people out there who are all dependent on this, their livelihoods, we come out as, you know, as unified as we can, you know, recognising there are obviously always going to be union management, you know, some tensions, but...
So that all the enterprise board meetings, that carried on through all that early first contract...
Yeah, that went right for 4 years in the end. Okay. That went longer than I expected. It went for 4 years. And we'd secured all the work. We were in a position where we were actually not just secured work, we were growing by going for other work. We were feeling positive that we could do work for other authorities. We were surrounded by South Cams, so we did work on grass cutting for them. We'd opened a PVCU window factory, so we did contracts for them. They had no function. I had a good relationship with their opposite number, Robin Smith there, Robin Carter rather, their director. And we had an interesting situation there because he was doing mainly refuse, which was all one contract, fine, we didn't want to know about that. You know, we got quite enough with recycling coming in waves with the authorities, so quite enough to keep us occupied there in expansion. But he had building maintenance, and funny enough, they had as many council properties as we had, but his authority put out three contracts and he was only allowed to win two. And we had conversations, and he said, Graham, he said, I'd rather you win the other one than the private sector, because he said, we can, you know, talk the same language. And so I said, well, we'll see if we can get on the tender list. It's a proper competitive process. So we got on the tender list, and we went for the, and I said to Robin, I made sure we wouldn't undercut him. So I knew what, I mean, I said, anyway, Robin, there's no danger of me undercutting you. I can't do it. I just couldn't do it for the price. And it was a peculiar set of contracts because all you had to quote, they had a load of schedule of rates for each job, you know, thousands of them. And it's every single job you can conceivably do in a house on this schedule of rates with a nominated sum for each job. You had to quote the percentage increase or decrease on that price. You can put in. So a very simple tender, you just had to put one figure in. And he was going in at plus 4% and plus 5% for each of the two contracts he'd had to win. And I said, well, the minimum I could do is plus 10%. And I then said to my Laurie Weaver, who was in charge of all the construction side, I said, well, 10% is too round. We're going at 9.9. He says, you do realise how much problem this is going to be when we have to price, when we send our bills in for all the scheduled rates. So I said, well, yeah, just humour me. So he did. Anyway, we put the prices in, and Robin phoned me up and said, oh, he says, I've come second. He said, I've got one. He said, I've got two con. No, he'd got one contract, and a private contractor had got two, and we come third. Oh, I said, oh, well, Robin, sorry about that. It was worth a go. But I said, we couldn't do it for any less, because I said, we mustn't leave our council taxpayers at risk. If we're doing this, we've got to make a surplus for our people. Otherwise, I said, it's goodbye to me from our politicians. Anyway, a week went past, and then Robin phoned me again. He said, you aren't going to believe this. I said, why? He said, you know the lowest bid? He said, it was minus 20%. I said, impossible. So he said, well, they've come back, because he said the winning tenderer gets to know the prices of all the other tenders. So he said, when he saw that they were 25% under the next lowest, they realised they'd made a major cock-up and they were going to be, you know, real problems. They'd really sort of not got a grip of what this was about. So he said they tried to convince the client that they actually put theirs was minus 0.2%. And so he said the client and the solicitors are currently looking at the documents with a magnifying glass to see if they could see the point. So I said, you couldn't make this up. So in the end, the solicitor said, well, he said, no, He says, we can't believe that. He said, you know, we just can't trust you. So Robin then, he moved up the list. He got two and we got one. So, you know, you do see some bizarre things. And of course, you know what they learned from that? Was in that contract, they'd only asked you to put the figure in. After that, you had to write the figure in as well. And that would have cleared it all up. But of course, these were early days. You know, there's lots of learning going on, not just by us, but by the client staff as well. But we did laugh. We still laugh about it, as you do all these years later. It's one of those sort of bizarre things you come across in your life.
So, but, so success in that period of growing and you know, getting work and contracts and so on. And obviously good communication was clearly one of your things with the Enterprise Board and so on. A little bit of luck with someone else.
Yes.
Doing, really messing up. What other, looking back now, what other things at that time do you think, even if you weren't aware at the time, were successful and things that you built on then? What happened at that time that you built on?
Well, I think the key thing was to get the trust of the workforce and the union reps, because even if the workforce didn't trust us, they trusted the union representatives. And if the union representatives were comfortable, they could communicate that to the workforce that, you know, Graham, this guy is to be trusted, and go along with this. We believe, we support it, and that sort of thing. So all the work that went into that in the early days, and going out with the workforce, going out with refuse guys on trucks and everything, and just sort of seeing how they function, what they think. It's interesting because you get with different parts of the workforce, you get a kind of a different dynamic. So building, because they're one man job. Well, they were one man. We got quite a few women when I'd left, but it was at the time it's man in a van. Don't see, hasn't it? His kind of view of life is quite different to guys in a cab on refuse, and even with gardeners. So you're not dealing with a collective psyche. You have to break it down and what best suits each kind of area of work. So a lot of work was done on communication in that process. And the trust came as well because we won. So the kinds of work, basically, you know, the jobs are safe, and we haven't scragged their terms and conditions. Still got the same pensions, still got the same pay, still got the same sort of sickness benefits, you know, well managed and monitored, but it's still there. Paternity leave, all the things that make up a local authority package, which you don't necessarily see as a complete package in the private sector, or certainly not in those days, you didn't see it, all helped to give this sense of, well, you know, it's a bad after all, and it could be worth a go. And but I think just to give you an idea in all of that, when we came to go for the refuse street cleaning bid, which was one of the biggest contracts, it was worth, well, we bid 1.8 million a year for this contract. And it was a 5-year contract. And it involved about 100, well over 100 of the workforce. So it was like 25% of the whole department. So it was a biggie. I put them erroneously, it was a mistake by me, when we had a trial, when I had arrived, they were just finishing a trial for introduction of wheel bins. And the guys that were doing it, instead of being paid a third bonus, were paid a 50% bonus. And we needed to, what we're going to do when there's a decision made, we'll go for wheel bins, roll it all out, what's the bonus going to be? And I can't even now think why I offered it. I think I offered it to buy at other terms. After a 66 and two-thirds bonus, because at the time, because we were going to wheel bins, we were going down from, I think, 12 crews to 7. So they were taking a big hit. I mean, a lot less arduous work. You know, you needed good leg work rather than having to lift, you know, the sort of injuries the guys were getting with back injuries would be a thing of the past with wheel bins. So there's lots of advantages to it. But in terms of numbers of staff, it had been decimated. And this was in the lead up to competition. And so I spoke to GMB and they understood. I said, look, we've got to do this. This is wheel bins. You know, we'll try and redeploy people where we can and we should be able to. So I said, well, how do we choose? You know, so I suggested to the unions, I said, look, you write down your list who you think should go or be considered for redeployment. I, with my manager, write down our list. when we presented, they said, well, I said, it could be quite interesting, couldn't it, as to how we think, you think. When we put the two lists alongside, they exactly correlated, except they'd chosen one more person than management. So you do get some fun out of it. Because we did manage to redeploy all those. Most of them, bad knees. If you were drivers, you had manual gearboxes, so their legs were, clapped out, or their knees were. And other guys, they were in their late 50s, and they were physically, it was a shame, really. A number of funerals I went to of refuse guys who died just after retirement, these people were physically completely shot. So the vast majority wanted to take retirement. And that just gives you a sort of idea of the flavour as to how things were, the communication process went on, and how it brought about, results in the competitive tendering process.
So you were, it was constant change you were overseeing at that point in terms of developing the site that we talked about, walking around this morning, reallocating parts of the services to different buildings, maximising the use of the space and all that sort of thing. And at that time, if you look back at that time now, what's the aspect of the work, of your job, that you are most proud of or feel was get a most biggest sense of achievement from?
I suppose because of the nature of work we're doing, it's the workforce, really. I think all the things, despite all those challenges and pressures which are still there now in local authorities, if not worse now, all the pressures to save money or make do the most you can with a given sum, if you like, do more for a given sum. That's how we tended to look at it, as a more positive approach. And getting and keeping the workforce support and a feeling that there was a kind of a oneness that we were. I mean, that was the good thing, I think I said earlier in the DAPO about competition, was we were in it together, because if it failed, we were all up the creek. It don't matter whether you were me, director, a manager, a supervisor, or a person on the end of a broom or the end of a toilet brush, in the toilets. We were all in that. And I think if nothing else, people could understand that dynamic and knew that. And that built up the kind of camaraderie, which is, I suppose I helped foster, because I think in those situations, you have to demonstrate. I mean, if you're a director, if you lead any organisation, you need two skills. You need leadership and communication. You don't need the technical skills, because why do you employ people to do it? Don't tread on their toes. I had to be very careful with my parks manager, because we trained in exactly the same way. He was a parks apprentice. He went to Kew, did the diploma course, and I had to really hold back. I couldn't, I thought, well, Dave thinks I'm going to be looking at him all the time and criticising. So I deliberately went and specialised in refuse, because we went through several managers, kept the same workforce. But I think they managed to finish off at least four managers in my time. So I tended to manage refuse and street cleaning more times than the actual managers whose job it was, which was fun. So I think that, and the other thing was, throughout all that, I think I've emphasised, we didn't sacrifice anything in terms of pay and conditions for people. Gave them decent uniforms, which they decided upon. And when we went for single status, we could have opted out. We could have had a bit like the euro. We could have had the opt-out clause. We didn't. We went into single status, and a lot of them benefited from it, but at the same time recognised we had to. There was no money pot for it. We had to still exist in the same contracts. And so that by then they were well used to making sure we could achieve that laudable aim of fair pay, equal pay for everyone, and survive commercially. And if we hadn't had that grounding and that trust, then I think single status, it wouldn't have been achievable. So you have that. And I think the other thing is part of it, the sort of diversity in the workforce, everything from introducing mature apprenticeship schemes, which became, in a way, introducing women into these frontline jobs, because a totally male-dominated organisation, spot the woman. Oh, there's one. That'd be about the only one you'd see out of 500 men. And I'm not pretending it's now, equal, because the sort of job's doing, a lot of women don't want to do them. You can't blame them for that. Some of them are extremely physically demanding still. But, there is a much greater diversity. I never thought I'd see the day in building maintenance where we had, at least 10 women doing tradespeople's jobs going into properties where vulnerable women are. It's all that sort of thing, and that you sort of see people, and I still see people. I see some. I had a meal with someone who's now head of maintenance, building maintenance and everything for the university at Cambridge, Sarah. She started with me in 1989 as an administrator in the highway section. She had her family, and while she was having her family, she trained to become a quantity surveyor, and that was 7 years at St Albans. So she had to go across at St Albans once a week for 7 years. And when she got qualified with honours, she then we got a job as area supervisor in building maintenance. She was able to move up on that. And then she became in charge of the building maintenance when the boss retired. And then she saw a job going to university, and she's there now. I suppose she's the classic illustration of going from that to that. So you take enormous pride in those sort of things happening.
And do you have any regrets?
Oh, yes.
Missed opportunities, things like that?
Oh, dear, yeah. I suppose the biggest one I had was a contract. It was our second contract for grounds maintenance. We'd won the first by a country mile. There was only one competitor that came forward. And then the second one went out the following year and included cemeteries, grounds maintenance and crematoria grounds maintenance, a number of other things, you know, in this sort of 25% package. And my grounds maintenance manager and a guy who was ex-work study who got specialist experience, I set them to on the contract, the bid, the tender. And the work, I reckon, was worth, on the budget that we had, about £165,000. And they come up with a provisional bid of £230,000. And I said, well, the authority hasn't got the budget for that. So I said, well, yeah, let's look through it. And they managed to reduce it to about £220,000. And they said, well, they've got snow clearance in it. And all these things that we haven't done before. They've got lots of extra things in. So I had real qualms about it. But I was in the middle of bidding for the refuse and street cleaning contract, which had its own worries, because we heard competition was very, very hot for that, unlike grounds maintenance. So two things happened. One, the guy who was the supervisor for cemeteries didn't tell us that in the last week a competitor had come forward and had a look around the cemeteries. He didn't think it was worth talking about. So that annoyed me intensely. And then when the bids came in, there were only two of us. This contractor won of £163,000. What's the budget? £165,000. We came in at something around about 220. What was the difference? Snow clearing. Because the contractor said, well, clearing snow won't cost us anything because you're employing us anyway. And if there's loads of snow on the ground, we ain't going to be doing grounds maintenance. And that was a big regret. Not so much losing the contract. It wasn't a high value contract. And to be fair, cemeteries was the sort of, it was the least worst option because they were a bit of a nightmare to do. It was never going to be an easy area of work. But it was the people, you know. And one guy, Gordon, he was a real good lieutenant. Gordon the Gopher, we called him. There was nothing Gordon wouldn't do, and he was very loyal and everything. And he was redundant in those days. The new contract, there was no Tupi, so the new contractor didn't have to take on staff, and they didn't because they wanted their terms and conditions, which were considerably less than the ones that were being, enjoyed by our staff. And within 6 months, Gordon was dead. And so you never get over that, really. You know, it always returns to your mind that what happened there, the fallout from it. But it redoubled the efforts not to have that again. You know, we didn't lose any other major contracts after that. But it was still, one you regret, really.
Yeah. And I'm just looking at the time, and actually you need to...
Yes, 10 minutes.
You need to wind up. Yeah. So I think we could be here for hours talking.
Sorry.
It's great.
Yeah.
No, it's lovely. There's lots and lots to ask. So I'm really going to just jump to my last questions, which is there anything that you feel is important or significant about your time at the depot that you haven't had the opportunity to talk about? Is there an aspect of the work or something about being physically on the site or out and about in Cambridge that we haven't touched on that you'd like to tell me about? And it's a hard one.
Yes. It's difficult, really. I suppose I'm describing what I miss. You know, it's definitely the people. I don't miss the job because I think looking back on it, and I did as a preparation for this, I looked through a couple of the old business plans, and you have to sometimes look at how did we do all that, And they were very stressful times. You remember, you know, you remember the good bits and some one or two of the bad bits. And by the time I got to 60, you know, I knew mentally, I could give physically, but mentally I was pretty shot, so I knew it became quite demanding. And one area I failed to mention was, you know, throughout it all, we had enormous support from the councillors. You know, I mean, you mustn't forget that this is sort of tripartite, really, management, unions, with staff, and then the councillors. And one of the gratifying things when it came to councillors, because we ended up with our own direct services board, so you had a kind of a, you know, bit like, you know, private business, weren't you? You know, a publicly quoted company, I suppose we were in a sense, we were certainly public. And if someone, and we had one or two people who'd come, you know, very, very occasionally from other departments to sort of, I don't know, present a paper or something at one of our boards, and it was always held in the depot, because every other council meet, every other committee meeting and everything was in the Guild Hall, which was the best will in the world, you know, it's a bit of a sort of, it's classic old school local government, you know, the environment, and not the people and what happens, but the building doesn't help, let's say. And the depot, we thought, well, you're at the hub of it, you know, there you are in our conference room, vehicles are going past, you're living the sort of peace, really. And someone came up to me and said, do you know what? He says, I came to your direct services board meeting. He says, no, I couldn't tell who was a manager, who was a union representative, who was a councillor. And I said, of course, that's, we're all in it together.
That's great. Yeah, that's a really good place to start. Thank you. Thank you very much, Graham. I'm going to switch off now. That's fantastic.
Jolly good.